This is Cliff, and tonight we have a fantastic interview, but there's something you should know. B, she's a real researcher, but George is not a real witness. Well, he kind of is, but we had to change his name. That's because we try to protect the witness identity whenever possible, especially when it's an ongoing situation like this. So George, the name George, is actually my friend's dog. And my friend's dog is not a Bigfoot witness, but that's what we're naming the Bigfoot witness for this episode. Again, we don't want this guy's name out. We don't want his location out. We want to protect not only the witnesses, but the Bigfoots involved in this situation. So yeah, B is a real person, a real name. George is a real person, but a, you know, not so real name. Thank you for understanding, and I hope you enjoy this week's episode of Bigfoot and Beyond with Cliff and Bobo.
You are now listening to Bigfoot and Beyond, featuring the OG bad boys of Bigfoot, the Dr. Heckle and Mr. Jive of Squatchology, the Chip and Dale of Bigfoot, and I'm not talking about the cartoon. Please welcome your hosts, the Bigfoot celebrity couple, Biff Klobo, better known as Cliff Berrickman and James Bobo Fay.
Yeah, Cliff, when you let me know earlier today that you were going to be free this evening for an interview with someone, I know you've been talking up about B. Mills and those footprints she got out of Ohio and the auto recordings that we've heard before. And I thought, you know, I got to talk to her anyways. I'm going to Hocking Hills to her event in 2 weeks. So I called her up and I said, hey, will you come on tonight? And she said, yes, I'd be glad to do it. Call me tonight.
Oh, fantastic. That's great. Because, you know, B is one of the best researchers out there right now. But, you know, again, not a lot of people know who she is. And a lot of people underestimate her for a variety of reasons, none of which are valid. You know, from everything stupid, like, well, she's a woman, to like, well, she's a little unusual. Yeah, she's kind of weird. But like, aren't we all? We're doing this, you know, but she is a rock solid investigator. She's been doing some of the best research out of anybody for the last couple of years, between her amazing Sasquatch vocalizations from Southeast Ohio to these footprints that she's cast this past year. They are phenomenal. And in my opinion, you know, if I were, you know, say Lauren Coleman, and I was looking for the next person to be cryptozoologist of the year, I think it probably should be B, because she has done so much excellent work. She is documenting as well as anybody is, and she's gotten some fantastic results out of one small area. So essentially, she's learning about this particular family group of Sasquatches, or at least the ones in that particular area, if it's not that same family, it's their neighboring family or something. But I can't say enough nice things about B, so I'm looking forward to this interview.
B Mills.
How are you guys tonight?
All right, great, how are you?
Wonderful, thank you.
Nice. I was musing earlier when I heard this might happen, that I'll be on with B and Bobo. if only I can be on with BB and Bo.
Oh my gosh.
Or BB and Bobo.
That works.
We brought you on to learn a little bit about your background and what you've been up to lately. So if you don't mind, let's get into it if you wanna.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I was just telling Bobo that I really admire all the work you've been putting in the last few years, and the results are really starting to come out too. I mean, we know you've been getting good, or at least I know, maybe the listening audience doesn't know, that you've been getting fantastic audio recordings for the last 2 or 3 years. We definitely want to talk about that. And then later we want to talk about these footprints that you pulled as well, because they're just astonishing as far as I'm concerned. So yeah, if you're open to anything, perhaps we should just start at the beginning. Like, what in the world are you doing looking into Bigfoot? I mean, how did that happen? Tell us how that evolved and what brought you here.
I've always been kind of a nature girl. I grew up in rural Pickaway County with nothing but cornfields, a patch of woods, and a creek. And that was about it, in the middle of nowhere. And school was 30 miles away, so I really didn't have much in the way of friends. But I had a lot of books and a lot of time outside. So first heard about legends and lore when I was young, but never really gave it much of a thought until, actually, funny story, I attended the 2013 Ohio Bigfoot Conference kind of as a joke, and it was just really exciting, and I was actually a little bit overwhelmed with the amount of people there who had all of these stories, and all of these stories just seemed to have a real common thread to them. And being the perfect gargoyle, just watching and listening all of this conversation going on, I thought to myself, there has to be more than this than just nothing. So since then, you know, met a few folks and wow, maybe call it beginner's luck, sort of. I had a thermal sighting maybe a month and a half later. And then in 2014, April 6th.
What was that? Where'd you have your thermal sighting? What did you see?
Oh, well, that happened. Okay, let me back up. So that during that weekend of the Ohio Bigfoot Conference, I was solo tent camping and never really been unnerved in the woods, never really got creeped out or felt the urge to leave. But that night was a completely different story. So much so there was, I literally packed up my tent, threw it in the back of my car, grabbed my food off the fire, put it in the front seat and drove 2 hours home. I know, right? So I reached out to a gentleman I had met during that conference and he kind of pulled it out of me. Like, why did you leave? Why didn't I see you? And I was like, well, I had to get home. And so finally I was like, some really weird things happened. All my electronics died. I had two brand new headlamps. They both died. A just really uncomfortable feeling. So we went back there, maybe that like a month and a half later. And I guess I went on my a site investigation, you could call it, being completely new, not knowing anything about this. And evening had fallen and it was dark out. And he said, hey, I've got a thermal. Have you ever looked through a thermal before? I said, no. So we went down kind of where I was camping that night. And well, there were, and you know, he was showing me, you know, that's a rock. Those are trees, you know, very basic things. And there we saw two deer, you know, four legs, two deer. It was across the water. And so I'm looking through it and kind of crazy. There was a new heat signature through the camera. And I hand it back to him. I was like, so what's this third thing? And he's looking through it and he goes, I don't know. And then he goes, oh, bleep. It just stood up. Oh, bleep. It just took two steps. And being a perfect gentleman, he handed it back to me so I could see what was happening. And I watched this heat signature that was much taller than the two deer who were still standing there walk up a ravine and just kind of fade away.
You can tell he's a perfect gentleman because he censored all the bad words he was saying with beeps.
No, I did that for you.
Oh, that was you. Oh, you're the perfect gentleman. I appreciate that.
You're very well. We got to keep it classy.
You attended the Ohio conference as a joke, but it appears the joke was on you at the end of the day here.
Oh, and it got so much better. I was actually embarrassed. And I think, and I was mortified and I kind of like those mysteries. And when I can't figure out something that, especially when it happens to me, you know, and it's like, why did that just happen? What's going on? Does this make sense? This makes no sense. I need to go find some clues, you know?
I know you're a certified naturalist. Were you at that time, or was that something that happened after your Bigfoot encounter?
That was after my Bigfoot encounter.
Okay. I just want to get it out there that you are a certified naturalist. Do you know what's going on out in the woods?
Oh, it's a wonderful program, and I absolutely encourage everyone. And I know in Ohio, it's the Ohio Certified Volunteer Naturalist. It's through the Ohio State University Extension Office. And, you know, it's just basically a class. I mean, anyone can sign up for it. And it's 40 hours. And fortunately, I'm in the Hocking Hills area. So all of our classes were in the field. So they were very hands-on. I mean, you're in the creek with, you know, nets and you are climbing hills and you are in the dirt. It's mind-blowing just how much of our natural environment's out there. And it kind of the symbiotic relationship between, you know, when you go out looking for Bigfoot and knowing your environment.
I would agree with that. I think that I've often said that Sasquatching, you know, Bigfooting in general, is a multidisciplinary gig, essentially, because you got to know a little bit about the animals, you got to know a little about the plants, you got to know a little about the ecology in general, the geology, the geography. You get on a list, man, you got to know a little bit about everything to be a successful Bigfooter. At least it sure helps. Maybe you don't have to, but it sure would help.
Oh, definitely. At least narrow down a what would be considered a good area.
Right. And really a naturalist, that's a word you don't hear a lot anymore, but it was a lot more common back in the 1800s, really, because at one time people were considered naturalists, and then the word science came up, because science is a fairly new term. It was like born sometime in the mid or second half of the 1800s, I believe. Before that, they were considered naturalists. And really, nowadays, I think naturalist is a generalist in science or outdoor sciences, whereas a scientist, a true scientist, is specialized, you know, a biologist or a chemist or a whatever, physicist, that sort of thing. But back in the day, a naturalist was a scientist before they got specific about their disciplines. So you're just carrying on but you're carrying on a tradition that led to science, essentially. So good for you.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've actually had to reach out to farmers and hunters, because I guess if in a different light, the outdoors folks, you know, the farmers, well, they have a different skill set and knowledge of the outdoors as opposed to the hunters. There's so much learning. I just love it.
Now, it seems that you're obviously inquisitive. You've got a good brain on your shoulders, and so may I ask, like, for the audience, what do you do for a living? How do you apply all these smarts that you've acquired?
So I'm a registered nurse.
Oh, okay.
My background is in trauma in the emergency room, and right now I'm working in kind of a specialty area in orthopedics and podiatry, believe it or not.
Oh. Oh, that's cool. What kind of insight has that given you?
You know, actually, some of these most recent finds, these casts, I've actually had a podiatrist look at them and vet them as being of a living individual, as opposed to, you know, like a platform.
I want to talk about the cast a little bit later, but let's put a pin in that for a minute, because I don't think that the casts are phenomenal. I put my own eyes on them. They're really, really great. But they're even better knowing the context of what's been happening in your corner of Ohio down there. So maybe we can back up a little bit from the cast, and we'll get back to them in a minute, and just talk about your research area and how you discovered it, or how it discovered you, depending on how you feel about it. And then what sort of work you've been doing there.
I was invited into the BFRO in late 2013, early 2014. And super exciting stuff. So I was kind of a, you know, newer investigator, didn't really have a whole lot of reports of my own. So I went out with different folks, but this phone call came in early June in 2016. And it came in through the, 1-800 hotline. And this gentleman expressed a lot of concern regarding possible Sasquatch activity. You know, so there were vocalizations, things were being thrown at his house. His family felt terrorized. And so Mark DeWorth fielded the phone call and did a quick phone interview with this gentleman. And then I got a phone call out of the blue and said, "Hey, you should listen to this. So, and do you know where this location is?" And I looked it up, and wow, I live 7 miles from there. I drive by that area almost every day. Is this for real? And so he said, "Well, we're going to go do a site investigation. Would you like to come?" I said, "Absolutely." So we get down there, and I'd already driven past the property a couple times and just, you know, looked at the area, pulled up some maps, tried to do my homework before I got there. And I actually beat my other investigators there. When we pulled up, it was like a scene out of a movie. His whole family was there. He had friends there with their entire family. And I park my car, grab my notebook and my recorder, get out. And this gentleman just comes flying around the side of the house. And he's dressed in full fatigues, complete with a boon ready. He had two sidearms. He had an ankle knife. He had an AR-15 strapped around his chest. This man meant business. And just by the look on his face, I felt like he absolutely meant what he, you know, the message that he left in his phone call, that, you know, he was concerned for his family.
George, he had a, when Clip and I went there, this is a couple years after that, he was out, he came out with a 30 round clip, you know, semi-automatic 308 rifle, and his son had a big, you know, high caliber rifle also. And they're quite the characters out there.
Yeah, George is unlike anyone else I've probably ever met. I love the guy. Although I will say he is an acquired taste, I suppose. You know, he kind of scared me at first, and I'm sure George would laugh to hear that. But yeah, he is quite the character. And I'm kind of surprised he only had two sidearms on, because there's a left and a right and a front and the back. So.
Oh, absolutely.
And when Cliff and I got there at the time, we went there, we heard an Ohio howl within 15 minutes of getting out of the car at like 2 in the afternoon, broad daylight.
Yes.
People can hear that, the message he left on the phone call, that original message is on the BFRO website. So if anyone wants to listen to it, it's a pretty compelling call. When you hear it, you get a sense of what was going on out there.
Well, you know, that might be something for our editor, Jeff Thomas, one of our two editors. He does all the film stuff on YouTube, you know, and of course, Matt Pruitt does our audio stuff. But maybe Jeff Thomas can go grab that and throw it on to, actually, maybe both of our editors can go grab that and throw it into the mix right now and just throw that in. That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, exactly. There's a really good write-up on it also. And I think, is there vocalizations included in that posting?
Yes.
Yeah. So you gotta check that out. It's on the BFRO website.
Or perhaps right now our editors will throw it into the show right now.
I have a Bigfoot issue, actually. You know, it's fine, cool, you know, screaming, howling, killing my animals, and I hunted it last night and started hunting me. I have crystal clear audio and pretty good video. All night video, but it is crystal clear, and it's been almost every night for a steady week. And it's at its point of just throwing stuff at us. I sent you in a thing a while back. A little bit of my background, Lieutenant Navy, 11 years, a large towing corporation. So I kind of want to keep my name out of the spotlight. But any ideas or suggestions before I kill it? Next step is killing it. I really don't want to, but. I don't know if you guys have a better idea than I do and know this is not a prank call. Thank you and have a good day. Again, my phone number is 7-
Yeah, that's right. Keep it. It's not live.
Yeah. Then again, maybe not. Maybe they won't. And I'm just saying this. Who knows?
Just want to keep the crowd, you know, the listeners, so they can check it out, so you know, they can listen for themselves and know what we're talking about.
It was rather emotional. It really was.
I got scared talking to George the first time, too. And I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding.
Well, when he did, you know, send that a clip that is posted on the BFRO website, that was kind of the pivotal moment where, all joking aside, we had that audio clip sent out to one of our linguists, and it came back. He vetted it, compared it to the one of the original recordings of, you know, the classic Ohio howl. And that was kind of that moment. And of course, you know, the witness kept calling and calling and calling, saying, what are you guys going to do about this? I asked for help. What are you going to do about it? And that's when we decided, let's get serious and let's start a recording project immediately.
Now, at that point, had George, the witness, seen one of these things or just been troubled and rocks thrown and all that whole thing?
He reports a history of having seen one. earlier. By the time we had gotten there, yes, he reported to us that one particular evening, there was things being thrown at the house and there were vocalizations. He told me his wife was locked themselves with her two children in their bedroom with firearms. And she told him, whatever it is, go out there and kill it. This gentleman, being the husband, father, strong man, went out there and went around. He has like a outdoor barn, and then he had two chicken pens. He had one for his chickens, and then further back near the tree line of his property, he had a pullet pen, which are just baby chicks. Baby chicks, they'll come right up to you squawking, wanting food. They have just no fear. Everything is going to give them a handout. But what he saw, it looked like a person that was actively reaching over a 6-foot cattle fence down into the pullet pen. I believe he said he yelled at it. The person / Bigfoot stood up and had a chicken in either hand and took off running towards the tree line. He said he went to go follow it. And by the time, and this gentleman, he's pretty active. He's pretty fit, ran after it. It had already gone down the hillside into his hollow. He has a hollow behind his property, and his home sits right at the mouth of it on the high point. So he's in a pretty advantageous place as far as game comes in. It had already gone down the hollow across this tiny little stream and was heading back up the side of the hollow by the time he caught visual on it. And he said he sat down to take a knee, lifted up his firearm, and then he heard noise coming up this, because it's kind of a like a promontory, almost a point. He heard noise coming up from one side, and it said like a branch fell right in front of him because there was a little game trail that went down to the creek. He took his eyes off, got the suspect with the chickens back in his sights, and then he said like a bigger, almost a log fell in front of him. And then he hears like a crashing noise, like something's coming at him, coming from either side of this point towards him. And that's when he made a full retreat, took off, ran back to the house, went into his safe, and pulled out a 50 caliber. It's not uncommon for, you know, country folk to have these kind of high-powered rifles. However, he said there was all the screaming going on and howling going on. And he said it was just absolute chaos. And he was so concerned, he actually just went ahead and started firing.
Well, he obviously missed. I mean, he didn't get it, right?
Correct.
Well, you know, when we went and visited, George showed me, he told me that same story. With probably fewer details, but we were actually on site at the time. And he says, you know, I was standing right there and like the fence was still bent over. They never quite fixed the fence or whatever. It was still bent over from that day. And I don't know if I remember, I'm not very excellent at judging distances or anything, but I would say George was maybe, I don't know, 60 yards away from the creature at the time, maybe. And George is a pretty athletic guy. He's pretty fit, you know. And when he took off chasing the thing and it went off into the woods, he said by the time he got that 50 or 60 yards, however long it was, it might even be fewer. Maybe it's like 40 or 50 yards, actually. I'll just say 50. By the time he traveled that 50 yards and stepped into the brush, the thing had already gone down the entire hollow, across the creek, and then up halfway, almost to the top of the opposite side of the slope. He said it was just standing there looking at him. And then he said it was just right there across from me. And I looked at that thing and I said, anything that goes that fast, like, I'm scared to death of. And he told me that, yeah, he was actually scared of the thing. And he's not the kind of guy to get scared of much. And that's when he went back to get a bigger gun.
You're going to need a bigger gun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. So when we did the site investigation, when we first arrived there actually, I think it was 2 days later, there was actually an impression that was in the middle of this small stream. Nothing castable just because of the water erosion, but there was definitely a print there, which is also available on that report to look at.
And so that kind of started it all off. This guy's stories, this guy's location, you were familiar with the area. And so you had yourself a research location. What did you decide to do with that research location?
We talked about it a lot, Mark Dorth and I. We decided to take a completely passive approach. Aggression is not usually something, at least in Ohio, you don't hear about the big aggressive Sasquatches. And especially, you know, he already had game cams down there. He already had, you know, big, bright barn lights. He had most of those things that, you know, would typically deter that kind of activity. So we figured a passive approach would be the best bet. So we started a LDR project, a long duration recording project on his property, just to help give his report more substance. And if there was this kind of activity going on, besides his report, perhaps we would be able to intervene. So what ensued after that was every night, all I had was a little Tascam DR05, absolutely not programmable, 8 batteries every single day. So every single day, I go out there, change batteries, make sure the card was working, and set the recorder to go off. So I tried to get there just before dusk. And when I got off work, I just stopped by on my way home.
Was it out of your way or was it on the way home literally?
Literally, it was about 2 miles out of my way. That's it.
Oh, that's pretty close though.
It's in a very interesting area. It's not in, you know, in deep woods. It's not, it's actually sort of on the outskirts, which, you know, 10 years prior would have been considered more rural, but there's a lot of agriculture in the area. There's still plenty of forest area, but the location itself is very interesting. It's right on the end moraines. It's right kind of where the glacier stopped and the last glacier aged and started creating the terrain that's more typical of southeastern, south central Ohio, where you have those kind of deep ravines, you have those, you know, sandstone, you have recess caves, you have, you know, and there's also the mouth of a river there, as well as two reservoir dams nearby and a wildlife area, very, very close, all within 2.5-3 miles. The results that we were getting were immediate. There were a lot of field trials that went on, a lot of trial and errors, a lot of different equipment. Reached out to a couple different folks who had experience with, you know, using recording equipment. Mm-hmm. And it's been quite a learning experience, but it was just impressive to get this audio recording just immediately and send it out, have it analyzed, and come back with such positive results in this particular area. So every day, it was kind of like one of those, I can't think of the movie, but, oh, it's from The Princess Bride, where he says, good night, good job, I'll probably kill you tomorrow.
Huh.
So every time I went out there, I made sure to go walk in that hollow. And I walked, and he told me I had access to all this property. And I said, okay. So every day I walked down there, and every day this gentleman would say, are you carrying any weapons? And I said, I've got a pen and a tape measure and a piece of paper. And he goes, well, you might not come out every day.
They say the pen's mightier than the sword, but perhaps not down in the hollow, huh?
Correct. You know, and I was actually hoping for some type of, you know, activity or anything, you know, to substantiate, you know, his reports of such aggressive behaviors. But I was down there constantly, and I personally didn't experience anything like that.
You're not obnoxious.
Well, thank you.
I can see George aggravating and the neighbors.
There's that. And, you know, and talking to the family, they had not done anything to provoke these kind of reactions or this, you know, they weren't doing wood knocks. They weren't doing howls. They weren't throwing things into the woods. So it was really a very interesting, you know, off the bat type of investigation, because it was all, you almost had to put together a scientific process for this. You know, you have the problem, what's going on, what's logical, what makes sense, and what kind of outcomes are we hoping to get out of this? So all sorts of things going on. And we're just trying to figure out what was the reason for all of this aggressive behavior. And as it turned out, the vocalizations kept intensifying during the summer and kind of reached a climax late August before everything kind of tapered down once because there was a cornfield that year. And when the corn came down and the leaves came down, then the audio stopped. And by that point, after, you know, late August, the aggression stopped too. And the family was a lot more comfortable even being outside. So, but taking that passive approach and reminding the family, don't agitate. And I know there are, you know, some people call it like habituators or habituation. And it was kind of like one of those, well, are they leaving? Because every once in a while they would throw, you know, food scraps and leftovers, you know, out in the woods behind the tree line. It almost seemed like a territory match. Like, these are my woods, you stay out of them, and I'm going to eat your chickens. But it was almost like these Bigfoot were habituating the family, if that makes any sense.
That's what they do.
Yeah, because they're not living on George's property. George is living on theirs.
You know, it really kind of seemed like that, because the home that they had bought, they had just bought in November of 2015, but not had moved in full time until that spring of 2016. And after that, that's when all this activity started and the aggression. Prior to that, the house had been empty for the better part of 3 years.
Oh, yeah. And of course, there's a history of sightings in this neighborhood. When Bobo and I were there, George invited a number of his neighbors over to tell us what's been going on in their lives. And the sightings have gone back decades and decades and decades until these middle-aged men were like young whippersnappers running around doing teenage stuff. They're running into these things in the neighborhood.
Absolutely. And that was a real eye-opener. And especially since the farmers, and these farmers, you know, they're educated, they are more affluent, they have nothing to gain from telling, you know, these stories. And if anything, there was kind of, you know, still that stigma. So, and when you guys came over, it was absolutely fantastic having them open up and tell these historical stories, because it just helped lend more credibility to this investigation and try to figure out, you know, what kind of clues can we pull out of this to establish some sort of, I hesitate to use the word pattern, but maybe like an ebb and a flow of their activity, I guess.
We're a farm of learned men.
B, let me ask you this. Why do you hesitate to use the word pattern?
I hesitate to use the word pattern just because I don't feel at this point I have, and I'm getting there. I'm more comfortable with it after, you know, working in this area for almost 4 years. It's just the documentation. Historically speaking, there is absolutely a pattern, but getting it on, you know, on paper where you can see. And I mean, stories are fantastic, but I'm really interested in the evidence.
I mean, I've been on my soapbox all summer long about that one issue right there. I'm trying to be nice about it, but it's time to move past the stories. It really is. You know, tens of thousands of stories of people seeing these things has gotten us here, and it's a great foundation to work from. And, you know, and if you're into stories and that's your main focus, then God bless you. That's fantastic. Chase what you like to do, by all means. But for the sake of the subject itself, it's time to move past that. We need to start gathering more evidence, start looking for these patterns that are hidden in the data. You know, if you're gathering stories, do something with them besides just retell them. Put them down on a spreadsheet. Look for dates. Look for locations. Look for moon phases. Look for temperatures. Look for barometric readings. Look for something that comes up again and again, because, gosh, it's just time to get past, I saw one. It was cool. I'm a Bigfooter. No, I saw one. It was cool. What was the moon phase? What was the temperature? You know, where were you? What other animals did you see? It's time to get past that, and it's time to get to the evidence, to the nitty-gritty. So I'm glad that you have also taken up that banner, B. So we can get shot on the battlefield together for toting that flag.
Wonderful. Yes. There are little threads that match. So it's putting those puzzle pieces together. So yes, I totally agree. I'm over here nodding my head. Yes.
Vigorously.
Very much.
So B, then you started this recording project on the property. How long have you been doing it now?
You mean what happened to my life?
No. Just how many years have you put in? And I want to ask you how many of your own dollars you put in. I mean, I know that's quite substantial as well because you're dedicated. But you know, what has it been, 3-4 years now or something?
It's been since July of 2016.
Yeah, so 3 solid years of doing it. And I mean, Bobo and I have both heard these vocalizations. Not a lot of them have been published, but I think they do constitute some of the best vocalizations ever recorded of a Sasquatch. And you have so many. Tell us about some of the more interesting calls that you've heard, that you've recorded, rather.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the best way I can describe those is to go by years, because every year seems to be just a little bit different as far as the vocalizers go than the previous year. So they're absolutely amazing. And so the 2016 found a total of 4 vocalizers. Finally, that year, I was there with my research partner, and we're on the property, and there's nothing quite like hearing a vocalization firsthand. It is just, it's one of the more breathtaking moments. It's one of those more, I don't even know what I'm hearing moments. You can't even wrap your mind around it. It's like the first time, you know, if you've seen a Sasquatch, there's just a complete disconnect. So having had that opportunity to hear it firsthand, even while it's being recorded, you know, it's just mind blowing. So, and then moving forward to 2017, we had the same, and the vocalizers, they almost have personalities, almost like your voice versus, you know, my voice, anyone's voice. You can tell someone by their voice. They have different tones, I guess, like a tonality to it. On the spectrogram, you know, they still hit within a certain frequency and a certain range, but the tone's just a little bit different. And so I was actually really fortunate to pick up all of this information. But there weren't as many vocalizers. In late 2017, early 2018, there is a new vocalizer now. And the best way I can describe this vocalizer is almost like a young man going through his adolescent phase, hitting puberty, and that his voice would crack. It would start off as just one of those beautiful long howls, and then his voice would actually crack. And that vocalizer seems to be one of the only ones this year in 2019. Sometimes they harmonize.
What do you mean by harmonize?
I could best describe it as almost trying to match pitches.
They're doing the same pitch, or they're trying to do the same pitch, you think, right?
Yes. It's like if you go to a choir or you listen to a group of singers, mm-hmm. you'll definitely hear, you know, the baritones, the basses, and, you know, the altos and sopranos. But when they all come together and they kind of harmonize while, you know, vocalizing, because for the most part, they typically traditionally do like an Ohio howl. I'll have to send you one of these clips. It's absolutely fantastic.
You said the most frequent is the Ohio howl. That's what we heard when we were there. Well, what else do you hear? Do you hear screams? Do you hear growls? You know, do you hear yells?
The families actually reported different vocalizations like that in my research and through the evidence that I've recorded. I have not recorded anything that I would actually consider a whoop or a scream. Now, the family also reports chatter, and it's they describe it as almost like children giggling in the woods. And they have had they're building a great big pole barn, and they've had Amish over there, and even the Amish came to me one afternoon and told me about hearing children in the woods. So that was pretty interesting. But those were all daytime, and my recorders actually run at night. So I tried having a daytime recorder, and I was not able to catch any of those. Now, interestingly enough, I was able to catch a growl, and it did it twice while their son, who at the time was he was five. Was outside. They had a little sun, like a sandbox just outside of their three season room. And you actually hear their son open the screen door. You hear the screen door slam. And after this impressive growl, and you hear the kid open the sliding door and say, "Words, words, Bigfoot." Huh. And then you hear the door slam again. Like, it actually startled this child. And even to this day, if you say Bigfoot, he kind of shrinks and runs over to his mom. I'm not sure if it's just he's too young, but anytime you bring up Bigfoot to him, he just kind of just walks away and laughs. And it's almost like he just really doesn't want to talk about it. So I really hope it wasn't terrifying, but it was so loud. I actually thought it was a chair scraping on concrete. Whoa. Until I played it again. It caught me off guard. I mean, the spike hit so hard. I was like, what is that? And no, we actually had that sent out to a primatologist. He said, yeah, that's a growl. I was like, wow, cool. So yes, that I do have. And then just different types of howls, but they all seem to be the howl.
Yeah, because they get them loud. I mean, George, I know the first recordings he got, he was inside his bedroom recording on just a cell phone. It was so loud. Is it a brick house?
Yes.
Yeah, and it was coming. You could still hear it through. It was so loud that you could hear it in the house through the brick walls.
Correct. And then the second recording, he actually opened up the window and held the microphone to the screen. And that's still one of the just an absolutely phenomenal audio clip. And that one's posted on the website as well.
B, do you hear a lot of knocking in the neighborhood, or is it just vocalizations?
You know, early in this investigation, yes, there were knocks. There were knocks. There were wonderful knocks. Since 2016, they really have not knocked at all. Randomly, intermittently, maybe I'll catch one or two a month, but not anything like you would expect or like it first started off. And then there was also some mimicry that was going on. Seemed to be a rather large population of hoot owls, great horned owls. They have a very particular call. They're solitary. They're not, you know, social like, you know, your barred owls or your screech owls. And there seemed to be a lot of these hoot owls. And one night, one of the hoot owls seemed to cough. But I know that they're, historically speaking, you know, people have said that, you know, Sasquatch activity included, you know, making pig noises or trying to imitate different animals. So I'm, while I can't vet that one, it was very interesting that as far as the knocks go, they're not really knockers.
Well, you know, I know that owls can turn their head quite a range, you know, almost 180 degrees. And it seems to me that often turning of one's head goes along with coughing.
Yeah.
The doctor wanted to do it, and he had to hold my privates.
You're a nurse. You know about this stuff, right?
Absolutely. You are correct on both accounts. So that was just one of the more interesting, things. But that's one of the fun things about doing the audio recording is you learn all sorts of night animal sounds. And thank God for hunters and YouTube if you get stuck and, you know, different people who are resources where you can say, hey, what is this? And naturalists, yep, go talk to them.
Yeah, you know, from what you've been telling us just from the beginning of this interview, you're doing everything right. You found a good situation. You decided to get in deep there. You're not spreading yourself too thin, in other words. You've chosen a research location that is easy to get to for you, 2 minutes out of the way or 2 miles out of the way, close to where you live. You are frequenting the area. You said you were going for walks down in the hollow. Almost every time you were there, getting to know the land, you're meeting the neighbors, you're getting the history of the area. And when you get results, you're not only sending them to experts, but when you get results that you can identify, you are actually reaching out to other people in similar communities, the hunting community or wherever, to say, hey, what is this? Can anybody identify this? You're doing everything right. Now, you should write a textbook about what you're doing as a researcher. It's fantastic, Lisa. Really.
Well, you have to keep your skepticals on. Sasquatch should be the last thing you go to. Rule out all of the other obvious.
That's true.
So, but thank you.
Well, thank you. I mean, you're doing a service to the community, and I really do mean that. So the vocalization stuff is still ongoing, right? And now when you go download or you get the card or something like that, or whatever you're doing, you get the card out of the recorder and you put a new one in, check the batteries or whatever you have to do, then what? You have this card. Do you listen to it in real time? Do you visually scan it for the right frequencies? Do you hire small children to do? I mean, what do you do to like get through this immense amount of raw data that you have to sift through?
That is a wonderful question. If I could hire someone to do this full time, if I could afford that, I absolutely would. It consumes so much time. It was a lot easier before the long duration recording project. And when I mean long duration, I mean, I can set the recorder out in the field. It can record for almost a month at a time. And I have found that I know it's really great because you can leave it in the field completely undisturbed where it becomes just part of a natural thing, if that's a thing. Whereas instead of, you know, a person being out there, you know, interrupting the environment every day, like I was. Mm-hmm. But the downside of that is now you have almost a month to try to get through. So I am actually fortunately backed up for a while. So what I try to do is blow through it, I guess, for lack of a better word, as quickly as possible, and then go back through it. I like to look at the entire segment on the spectrogram, and then I go through it and I hit the peaks and the highlights and the spikes individually. And you can't rely on the spectrogram solely just because of all the extra ambient noise. You have to, it takes time. It really does because especially, you know, we have cicadas, we have crickets, we have frogs, we have whippoorwills. You want to talk about one of the most obnoxious creatures on this planet when you're going through audio is the whippoorwill.
How did you learn how to do what to look for on the spectrograph?
there was a lot of trial and error. And actually, Monongahela has a website, and it's Sasquatch Bioacoustics. And he uses Audacity to look through his, but he has enough information on there. And I also reached out to another gentleman, Charles Kimbrough, as well as an Ohio investigator, Charlie Page, and talked to them a little bit about how they, what their methodology is for this. So I actually, believe it or not, my son, he records his own music. He's quite the musician, and, you know, has an album and all this other stuff, but he records his own music through a program called Reaper, which is very similar, but there's still a learning curve. So he actually taught me how to use the program, and then fine tuning it, and based off the data that I received from, you know, the different vetted reports, you're able to put together an algorithm that works. And then if there's anything that comes up that, you know, it's just really, I just can't put my finger on, then I, you know, I send it out and have someone else analyze it and just either legitimize or give some pointers on, you know, the sound clip.
Right. You know, Audacity is a fantastic program for listeners who are interested in this avenue of research because it's totally free. It's widely used. You can learn a lot about it online from the community who's already put it into use. It's one of the more common software. And like I said, totally free. You go download it right now while you're listening to the podcast and jump in right away. So you don't have to use Reaper or any of those other grim softwares, but you can use Audacity or anything else and do a great job. And by the way, B, let me ask you, I know that you've upgraded your audio equipment, your recording equipment, probably several times over the last 3 years or so. But you started out, you said earlier, with a Tascam. And I don't get nosy or nebby, as they say out in your corner of the world. But how much did that cost? Like $100, something like that?
Yep. I went to, I think it was Guitar Center, and it was $100. And I was so broke when I first started, I went to Best Buy and bought a $30 Sony.
Yeah, exactly. You made my point beautifully that if you're interested in this avenue, you don't even have to be there. You can just put it out and let the batteries drain with a less than $100 piece of equipment and free software. And boom, you are a Bigfoot researcher trying to record Sasquatch vocalizations. And everybody's got to start somewhere. And eventually, 3 years down the line, you can be like B and upgrade your equipment and stuff. But everybody should be out there trying to bring back something beyond a story. And audio recordings are fantastic bits of evidence. They don't solve the puzzle, nothing you can take to the bank, but they build on our knowledge. And more importantly, as B was saying earlier, they build on your knowledge about your specific Bigfoots. You think there's four of them in your neighborhood and a new one might be going through puberty even? That's a pretty wild hypothesis, but why not? Why shouldn't that be a hypothesis? Now it's time to gather evidence to support that hypothesis. You know, footprint tracks of the appropriate size, sighting reports of a similar animal, that sort of thing. So again, textbooks. You should think about a textbook, B. You're fantastic.
I've had a lot of mentors, so just putting together what works.
I've had a lot of poor mentors.
Yes, so thank you too. I appreciate it.
If you could have if you had like some dream equipment to get, what would you want to get if you had a sponsor?
Oh my gosh. If I had a sponsor, oh geez, I would get surveillance equipment. The audio equipment now is, we actually have it hooked up to a solar panel. So it drains almost zero battery life. It is in a great location in the field. The test, it's been out in the field for 3 months, and it's been flawless. So at this point, and what I kind of wanted to do back when, you know, the Sasquatch were on his property, was set up a security system, almost like a continual feed. That would be amazing. Because and the reason I say that is because there's actually a gentleman who lives, as the crow flies, 3 miles from this particular property. And he has a recorder that he puts out as well, kind of on the backside of his property. And there was one particular occasion he sent me an audio clip and I was able to match it with one.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean match it?
He had the timestamp. He had the date. I pulled my recorder, my file, and I was actually able to match the vocals.
Oh, it was the same vocalization being recorded at two different locations at the same time.
Exactly.
Oh, wow. I'm not sure that's ever been done before.
Well, there you go. So, but that led me to believe that it was possible or even plausible to figure out and kind of determine, you know, what area these vocalizers are, where they're at. So some form of, I mean, the game cams are great, but not exactly perfect. But having something, you know, a little bit more savvy as far as the technology field goes and surveillance, that would be my dream piece of equipment.
You know what would be interesting to obtain for your specific research site, if anybody has really deep pockets and is listening and wants to help B out, I guess the police or military utilize some sort of technology that basically listens for gunfire and then has a directional sort of unit in it as well. So if they hear gunfire, they can tell what direction is coming from. Wouldn't it be interesting to set up two or three of those along the hollow and tune it to listen for vocalizations? So when two or three, you'd only need two, but three would be better. If two different recording units picked up a vocalization or a knock or whatever, they could triangulate and locate where that thing is exactly, pretty much, probably within a few yards or a few tens of yards at least, which is way close enough. That would be a dream piece of equipment for your audio project as well, I would imagine.
How much does that cost, Liv?
I have no idea. I have no idea how much that costs because I know that I can't afford it, so I don't even bother looking.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't know how much Lamborghinis cost either for the same reason.
Right.
That's brilliant because I tried to research just because of the terrain with the, you know, the valleys and then, you know, the plateaus, even the hills, you know, the farms, different terrain, kind of, it changes sound. And if you've ever tried to read up on, you know, sound waves and how sound carries and how sound travels, that's a doctorate degree.
You ever tried these parabolics?
Yes.
How'd that work out for you guys?
You want the truth?
Yeah.
I made it out of a pastry lid and a mono mic.
That's all right.
Did it work?
It worked great.
Oh, that's hilarious.
It really looked hillbilly hilarious. Yes, but you know what? It worked. And I had it set up through the recorder with a set of headphones.
Those work good. We've seen people with like plastic big Tupperware salad bowls mounted on PVC pipes, and they're getting good audio that way.
Yeah, I mean, it works the same. It does. It's just, sometimes you got to think out of the box and on the fly. And there was one night we were over there on the property, and there was a vocalizer that was just going to town. But it was so far away. It was so faint. I just went digging through my car, and you know what my car looks like. That explains everything. And yeah, I had a pastry lid in there.
Yeah, you don't need to spend a lot of money to, you know, none of us start out doing that. You know, it takes, you know, a lot of obsession to start spending a lot of money on things. You know, start slow.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Bigfoot and Beyond. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us on iTunes. Subscribe to Bigfoot and Beyond wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Bigfoot and Beyond Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Bigfoot and Beyond, that's an N in the middle, and tweet us your thoughts and questions with the hashtag Bigfoot and Beyond.